This is New England Public Media News. I'm Kari Ngiri. In the early 2010s, the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court put together a task force of people from all over the criminal justice community. They studied how eyewitness evidence is used in the courtroom and offered science-based recommendations going forward. But it left many people who were convicted before the report still in prison. New England Public Media's Karen Brown has part two of our series, Questioning the Witness.
My name is James Watson, and I was wrongly convicted for a crime I did not commit.
Watson was 20 in 1979 when Boston police officers turned up to ask him questions about the murder of a cab driver named Jeffrey Boyajian.
You know, look for, witnesses. Anybody hear anything or see anything? You know, they knock on people's door. They knocked on my door, and then they stayed at my door.
At the time, Watson was unemployed, a new father of an infant. He told police he knew nothing about the crime, but they said two eyewitnesses saw him get into Boyajian's cab the night he was killed.
I said, give me a polygraph, you know, lie detector test, whatever. And it would come out, you're focusing on the wrong guy. It never happened.
One witness was another cab driver named Richard Dwyer, who said he saw, from across the street, at least two black men get into Boyajian's cab. According to records found years later, Dwyer only picked Watson and his co-defendant out of a photo array the second time he looked at it. And that was after he was hypnotized at the police station.
You will see it clear in your mind.
On a recent episode of the NPR podcast Hidden Brain, actors read from a transcript of the police hypnosis in that case.
When the documentary begins, it will be of you sometime around 4 o'clock this morning, sitting in your cab. I am going to slow the frames down now.
I'm scared.
Scared? There's nothing to be scared of. You're just watching this.
They're going to do something bad to him. They're going to do something. I just don't like them.
Watson's lawyer, Barb Monroe, says back then, hypnosis was considered a legitimate way to extract evidence from a witness, as though memories were hidden just under the mind's surface in perfect photographic form.
I mean, we know that's not true now, but it's very riveting back then, and any jury's going to believe that and say, oh, wow.
When James Watson thinks about this evidence today, well, he just shakes his head.
It was bizarre to me. I don't believe in hocus pocus. And that's what that is, hocus pocus. Something you put in a movie for laughs, not for life.
In addition to the hypnotized cab driver, there was a witness named Neil Sweat. He had refused to make any identification during two photo arrays until, according to court documents, the police promised to move his family out of a housing project. Like Dwyer, Sweat was white, and scientists believe cross-racial identification is more likely to be wrong. Watson's lawyer, Barb Monroe, says Sweat was also cognitively impaired.
You know, you have somebody who is intellectually disabled looking out a window 75 feet away at 4 a.m. in the morning and can identify a black man unequivocally, that is ridiculous to me.
Nevertheless, in 1984, after two trials, Watson was convicted of murder and sentenced to life in prison. He tried to stay busy there, painting, learning to hang sheetrock, so that he could fall asleep at the end of the day. But most nights, he couldn't stop his mind from obsessing.
Why me? You know, why'd you pick me? Of all the real bad people out there, you pick me.
That question is both existential and practical. Why was he picked? Since DNA started to exonerate people, the Innocence Project has found that 70% of wrongful convictions were the result of bad eyewitness testimony. Watson had been insisting for decades the witnesses were wrong. And about 5 years ago, a new set of lawyers took over his case.
I was just praying and hoping that, you know, this time something good happened.
Before we go further into Watson's case, let's look at what happened to another man, Tommy Rosa.
In 1993, when he was convicted, there were many things that were told to the jury that were scientifically incorrect.
Radha Natarajan is head of the New England Innocence Project. She's also a lawyer for Tommy Rosa, who was 24 in 1985 when a woman named Gwendolyn Taylor was killed in Boston. Shortly before the murder, Taylor had come to a friend's door in a panicked state with a man who was threatening her.
This man, the stranger, was behind her. He was holding a shiny object up to her neck, It was dark. The street lights actually were broken.
The two of them left, and the next day, Taylor was found dead. Her shaken friend was asked to come to the police station and look at mugshots.
You know, they didn't have any suspects in mind at the time. She said, I think it's a Hispanic man, and they gave her mug books.
Decades later, the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court warned against that kind of photo array because it invites wild guesses. Back then, Rosa's photo was among the mugshots because he'd been previously arrested for marijuana possession. The witness chose Rosa.
There's all this pressure on this eyewitness to pick someone so the investigation can be completed and so that there's some feeling of justice. And this eyewitness went through these books and she picked someone who she later realized she actually had seen at the bus stop. And what we know now is that it's so easy for eyewitnesses to make mistakes about where they saw someone.
Natarajan believes Rosa's case shows how poorly the workings of memory were understood three decades ago. Take the role of stress and trauma. The prosecutor in Rosa's case told the jury the witness was clearly traumatized by seeing her friend with a knife at her throat.
He actually said it makes an imprint in your brain, in your memory, and you will never forget. That's scientifically incorrect. Trauma actually makes it harder for the brain to create an accurate memory.
Plus, there was a cross-racial identification, the viewing time was short, a weapon was present, which can make it hard for someone to focus on a face. And the prosecution claimed the witness's confidence made it likely they were right, though research shows that's not true either. Today, after a 2015 court ruling in Massachusetts, the judge must instruct the jury on these scientific principles. But that didn't help people like Tommy Rosa.
So the court said, we're saying that every case going forward is going to have the benefit of this, but we're not applying this to cases going backwards.
That was frustrating to people in prison who felt if the rules had been different during their trial, they wouldn't have been convicted. But Western Massachusetts prosecutor Stephen Gagne says it's unrealistic to make the rules retroactive.
You know, if we judged a case from the 1950s by today's standards, I mean, I'm sure most of them would probably not hold up very well with time. Science is always evolving.
And if cases were constantly being re-examined.
There's no saying how far back you could go and have cases reopened and victims suddenly getting a phone call saying, hey, you know that case from 1978? It's been overturned. So I think the courts try to strike the right balance.
The New England Innocence Project and other lawyers took on Rosa's case anyway. Decades after the murder, they tested clothing from the victim, which ruled out Rosa's DNA. Then they went through eyewitness evidence they say should have been questioned at trial. And in October 2020, after 35 years in custody, Rosa was released, at least for now.
This is awesome!
How you feel, Tommy?
Great.
A judge allowed Rosa to leave prison while his appeal is being argued, partly because of the risk of COVID in prison.
Tell us about when you found out you were going to be coming home today.
She said, I have some happy news, and I got very happy. Because sometimes you always thought this day would never happen.
So let's get back to James Watson. He'd been in prison for more than three decades before Barb Monroe and Madeline Weaver Blanchett took over his appeal. Like with Tommy Rosa, they focused on eyewitness principles that have come to light since Watson was convicted, from how far away the witness was to the use of hypnosis. Today, Blanchett says,
those identifications would be subject to motions to suppress or to exclude. They would be so vigorously cross-examined.
In November 2020, a judge vacated Watson's conviction. This was a few years after his co-defendant, Fred Clay, had already been exonerated. James Watson was declared free after 41 years in prison.
Just to be able to walk down the street, you know, with no shackles, no cuffs, nobody telling me, you can't go here, you can't go there, turn right, turn left, stand still, you know, it's amazing.
Still, it's hard for him to really believe he's in the clear. Given how little evidence was needed to lock him up, he doesn't believe anyone is. Certainly not a 6'5" black man.
You know, I stick out. I was black, poor. They needed somebody to lock up for this. And they chose me.
He's always on eggshells. He still half expects a visit from the police.
When I hear about a crime similar or close to it, I just lock my door.
You don't think that things have changed since 40 years ago? You don't think the system is any better now?
No. The system is broken. It's broken.
He tries not to be bitter. He'd rather focus on spending time with his son and grandchildren. But he would like to see some things change in the criminal justice system.
Get more training. Do the investigation. You know, just don't go on a whim. Actually look into the case. Don't reach your hand into a hat and pull out a bunch of names. You know, do your job.
For New England Public Media, I'm Karen Brown.
Tomorrow, in part three of our series, Questioning the Witness, we'll look at the steps some police, prosecutors, and scientists are taking to make eyewitness evidence more reliable. This is New England Public Media.